Welcome to CoastSiderRadio.com's Look at Local Musicians. This will be a show where we will highlight one musician, the person's story, and the music. Today, up is Tom, and he has some fascinating and interesting stories to share with us. And Tom, why don't you tell us everything you know about music and try to keep it under 30 minutes?
That shouldn't be too hard. Music for me started, let's go back, 1968. I had just moved to England. I was deported from my mother to my father, and I'd had some legal issues in 1967, and this was the solution. When I got there, I was put in a private school, and at that school I met some people, which is what I do, what I have done and do. And I was over at my friend Richard's house one day, and we were all sitting around, and they were all in a band. And of course, who didn't want to be in a band back in 1968? So they were talking, and they said, hey, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. They were reading lots of magazines about music, and they were going to the Marquee Club occasionally, and I already knew about the Marquee Club and the Tiles Club and a few of the other places, but so I said, hey, you know, I want to be in a band. And they said, well, we need a bass player. And I said, I can do that. So I went home and I got my dad to buy me this bass, and it was just a bass to me. Looking back on it, it was more than just a bass. It was a Teardrop Fox Wyman bass, and anyway, I had no idea what happened to that bass, but it was pretty exceptional for a bass. So I thought, well, you know, just teach me how to play some riffs, chords, not chords, but anyway, I said, just show me some things in a key, like notes that I would play in the key of C or something like that. That's what I knew about music, and you have to really understand that where I come from in music. As a young boy in church, I would try to sing with everyone, and they would actually tell me, don't sing, Tom. You're so far out of key. So let's establish that I'm tone deaf and can't carry a beat. That's where music began for me. So I got this bass guitar, and I assumed that I could just play some notes anyway. We all know that wasn't going to happen. So they said they had a gig at this British high school, and we were going to play this little set of songs, and one in particular called Destiny and Company. And that was going to last about 30 minutes, which might be the length of our time on stage. So they said, Tom, this is what you're going to do. You're going to go dum da dum da 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 dum da dum, and that's all you're going to do. And all you have to do is listen to the drummer and stay in time with him, and Steve and I'll do the rest. And this was Richard talking, the composer and singer. So I said, okay, cool. So as we get ready to do this, I went downtown and I bought some hash and I stashed it at Richard's house. And I thought, well, we'll smoke this tonight before we do our gig. So later that day, the phone rings and it's Richard. And he had never really done anything like that before. But so he decided to sample this hash, and he calls us up and he goes, I'm on a bent trip or something like that. So he was out. He couldn't go. And Steve and Pepper, the drummer, and I decided we're going to go anyway. So we took all of our gear down to this school in, somewhere in London. I can't remember where. It doesn't probably matter. And we set it all up, and the kids were trying to dance, and they couldn't because there wasn't any music to dance to. We did start the song, and Steve launches into this song, and he's singing it. And all of a sudden, he just goes out of control, and he grabs a mic stand, and he just starts sliding it up and down the keyboard of this Fender Stratocaster. And he's in this flowery, long, flowery robe, and he's like total 60s kind of rocking out kind of guy. And Pepper's this Welsh kid, and he's in the background drumming. He can't hear a thing. And, of course, I'm over in the corner going, doom da doom da doo da doom. And it was a disaster. And we eventually wrapped it up, and the kids that were at the dance were really pissed because they couldn't dance. And so we quickly gathered all of our gear, and we ran out of the school as fast as we could, and because we knew they were going to beat the absolute crap out of us if they could get their hands on us. But another band started setting up, and they got interested in that, and it gave us this window of opportunity, and we dragged all of our equipment out, and we got on the bus, and we laughed our butts off on the way back. So that was my first experience as a musician, and it was pretty funny, actually. I have no idea what happened to Richard that night, and he totally wigged out. I'm pretty sure he's probably still a little goofy from that. And that's kind of where we all began, and we'll pick it up from there.
Tom, that's a fascinating story, but back in those days, hadn't you heard about monitors so everybody could hear what's going on stage?
We were lucky to have guitars and a couple of amps, and they were really, you know, beat up. I think Pepper had a bass drum and a snare and a couple of cymbals. So, yeah, we didn't have any idea what a monitor was, let alone any kind of sophistication whatsoever in the world of music.
Now, you don't have to answer the next question, but did before you played this gig, I wish it would have been there, it would have been priceless, how much of the hash did you guys go through before you got on stage?
Well, see, that's the interesting part. We couldn't get it because Richard had it at his house, and he got all flipped out and couldn't come out of his bedroom, and we didn't want to, you know, bust him in front of his parents, so we just left him and it alone. So we did it on the Natch.
Yeah, it's amazing. Musicians get pretty creative. I remember one time in Southern California, the band I was with, we were playing at a religious institute place, and during the breaks, what we had is we mixed up screwdrivers, except it was about four parts vodka to one part orange juice.
Yeah,
if I could only speak.
Perfect.
And so we were having a great old time. Of course, the venue to whom we were playing obviously was stone cold sober, but we thought we got better as we got going on.
that's sort of how it happens, you know. So, well, that's good questions. We knew nothing about music, though, literally.
Well, let me ask you, you're doing a different type of music today, and
yes.
we want to throw some of that in here in short order. So why don't you, let's pick one of your songs, and before we start playing it, why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Okay, to do that, what I really need to do is I need to backtrack. So that was my first sort of introduction to playing music in a band. And, of course, I never played another gig live in my entire life. That was it. That was the end of the beginning and the end, the alpha and the omega. So, but what happened was my friend Steve, he lived down in London, and his father was a piano player, and his sister was pretty interesting, and she had this boyfriend, and his name was Sebe. I think in the end, we all knew his name was Dale Bennett, but at the time, it was Sebe Cochise Anadie. And this guy was pretty bizarre, and he was a songwriter, and I know that sounds pretty bizarre, but as I got to know him better and better, he had this driving force, and his goal was to become known as the old man of pop. And you have to understand that this was a runaway guy, and he lived in a kid, actually, and he lived in a tree in Hyde Park, and that's the truth. And he was like, he had this personality that when he would walk into a coffee shop or something like that, it would just get really quiet. Everybody would look at him.
Let me ask you one question. Do you have any idea what this guy's name means?
Yeah, Sebe stood for sad eyes but beautiful eyes. And he said some girl told him that once, so he just decided that he would call himself Sebe. And you have to understand that every picture you've ever seen of Jesus Christ hanging on a wall is what this guy looked like. It's bizarre. And never had a haircut or never shaved. He just looked like that. You know, so I think what it was there was a little bit of him that was a renegade, so he decided that his middle name should be Cochise. And because he's an artist and a musician, he needed some flowery kind of name, so Anadie, you know, solved that. So this was what I learned from him was this, and this is what's important, is that to him the music really wasn't that important. What was important is that it was an image that he wanted to sell to the world, and he had decided that marketing music was not about, oh God, I love my music, man, I'm so into my music. His was all about, you've got to do something really spectacular, but it isn't about that. It's about what the people perceive of who you are, and that's where it launched from. So I started hanging out with this guy, and we started doing, we started kind of trying to play some of these songs that he wrote. And I was still in high school at the time, and one day I was asked to write this essay. I can't even remember what it was about at school. So I took a paragraph or a stanza from his song, and I put it in this paper I wrote, but I put it in quotation marks so that it was clearly not mine. And I turned the paper in, and the next day the English teacher called me aside, and she said, you know, I've got a degree in English lit, a master's. I'm well read, and never in my life have I ever read anything that was written with such control as that paragraph you inserted into your paper. Who wrote that? Okay, the reason I tell you that is because when I tell you this guy was a writer, I mean, he was phenomenal. And these songs that he wrote were actually like as beautiful as Leonard Cohen ever wrote, as beautiful as he ever wrote, but they were as hard-hitting as Bob Dylan. So he was like this Buddhist songwriter that had this eloquent little, cute little style. And the whole idea was, as he said to me one day, he said, look, you and I can get together and do this, and because you're like completely different. You're like this total, for lack of a better word, he used to call me the fabulous idiot. I mean, it was just like, I was just having fun. And he was like doing, I don't know, the combination of the yin and the yang actually is what he envisioned. I had no idea what he was thinking or doing. I was just, so in the middle of all of this, I was having more problems with my domestic relationship with my father, as I had had with my mother, as I had had all my life. And the next thing I know, I woke up at 2 a.m. and I took everything I could get my hands on in my bedroom and I left home. And I was still in school, but I moved downtown London, and I lived, and Sebi and his girlfriend were renting this room in this apartment building at the time. So I just moved in with them. And I've never lived at home since that night at 2 a.m. And I'll never forget that night, because I had these drugs that my friend sent me from Newport Beach, California, and they were like Reds, which are sleeping pills. So in my infinite wisdom, at 2 a.m, I took them just to get myself screwed up. And then I took everything and I stumbled down, and I somehow found my way down to Baker Street, and that's where it all began. And he and I began from there, and what happened next begins to become the fodder to what we're going to talk about.
Well, Tom, we've been listening to your music quietly in the background, and maybe this would be a good time for you to tell us a bit about that.
Okay, I can try and do that. I actually did not do anything with music personally other than just play crummy guitars until about the late 1990s, say 1996, 97. Earlier in my life, once when I was 20, I got drunk and I kindled my guitar and all everything I'd written and put it in a fireplace out in Silverado Canyon, California. Just, you know.
Wasn't that going a little overboard?
Well, you know, I mean, I was drunk and I thought, you know, this just sucks and I suck and I'm done. Because I've never really petitioned anyone to believe that I was a musician, and I don't. However, just going back to London, what took place during that period in my life was I got involved in this, I don't know, I guess you could call it an act. But at the time, I didn't know I was acting. I wasn't sophisticated myself enough. And this Sebe guy was like dynamic. And I won't bore you with a lot of the other things, but we lived in, we went from Chiltern Street to Bayswater to Gloucester Court and finally down to East Putney, which is the Drudge. But, and from there we got arrested because we moved into this room that we thought we could live in for free for a while, and there were these drug dealers who just moved out, and it's a long story. So after we got out of jail and everything, we were still working on this this thing, and we were living out in this place in north 6 miles north of London. And Sebi said to me one day, he said, you know what, I'm going to put an ad in the London Financial Times in the personal section. And I went, why? I don't understand. What are we doing here? And I go, what are you going to say? And he goes, I'm going to say, wanted, a Brian Epstein, in quotes. And now Brian Epstein, of course, if anybody knows their salt about the 60s, was the Beatles, was the guy who believed in the Beatles so desperately that he made them who they were. So he puts this thing, and I didn't believe in this. I went to bed the night before. I woke up in my little room. I was asleep. I woke up about 11 o'clock, and I got out of bed, and I dragged my long-haired self out to the living room, and he's sitting there, and he's had like 15 or 20 phone calls. And it just started right there. I mean, we got calls from an attorney. We got calls from an agent. We actually got calls from people who had connections to Jack Bruce's home studio of the bass player for the Cream. I mean, all of a sudden, these doors just swung wide open. And I was amazed, completely amazed. And I think Sebi was terrified. So, I mean, that's from that came all of this music that you're listening to in the background. The belief that you can do something You know, and I just kept writing and singing and writing and singing after I got home back from the UK. And I won't even bore you with that, but that ended poorly and I had to come home and, you know, everything was like that. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit more about that or go further into the music.
You know, Tom, I'm fascinated by this because, you know, not many people end up with that kind of a situation. And for someone to have the temerity and the audacity to put something like that in the paper and start getting all this stuff, you know, that gets pretty heady. So you've got these opportunities sitting there. You're kind of like in the driver's seat. I got to ask you, what happened?
Okay, you know, this is exactly what happened. We fiddled around with some people that let us down. It took a couple of 3 weeks to get our way through it. But there was this attorney, and he was driven by this guy named Derek, who was an advertising agent magnate in London, who was living out in the north end of Hampstead Heath in the Greenwich Village section. And he ended up to be a really cool man. And Tony was this attorney. And so he tells Tony, this lawyer, this ad is brilliant. Call these guys. Find out what they're all about. You know, so when he called us, we got together, and anyway, we talked about it and everything, and Derek said, I'm going to get you into a studio. And we said, okay, great. So he got us into a private studio in Hampstead Heath, and it was gorgeous. And there's a side story to that, but I'm going to leave it alone for now. Maybe we'll circle back to it. But he was going to get us a piano player, a bass player, I think maybe a drummer, but at least a bass player and a piano player to help us get this stuff recorded correctly. So we said, okay, that's fine. And the songs are pretty simple. We figured we could teach them what we wanted them to do. If I could play them, anybody could play them. So we get there, and the piano player was this washed-up drunk who used to play blues and jazz. I mean, he was horrible. And the bass player thought he was Jack Bruce. I mean, we would say, what we'd like you to do is go dun 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 dun. And he'd go, okay, I got it. And he'd go, dun dun dun. And we're like, well, stop. And the whole thing was a total mess. And there was one guy running the equipment named Tom, and he was excellent. And he was like looking at us like, geez, what are we doing? And so finally we called Derek and we said, here's the deal, Derek. Either you get every single buddy out of this house except this one guy, Tom, or we're walking. It's up to you. And in 20 minutes, that house was empty. And it was just me and Sebi in the studio and Tom behind the glass. And in about 30 minutes, we put down maybe five or six of his little ballads. And that's really what they were. And I could tell you the names of them if I stopped and thought about it. Hardly matters. So we leave. And of course, we're feeling really bad. We're like, wow, man, we had a great opportunity. We just blew it. And so we went back to our little, as a matter of fact, we were still in Gloucester Road at the time. So the timing is a little confusing. Maybe Gloucester Road was after it in North London. I forget. Anyway, we were in this place in Gloucester Road on the fourth floor. And we were thinking, they said, well, we'll call you in a week or so once we figure out what's going on. That was like a Thursday or a Friday. On Saturday, the next day, the phone rings downstairs and we go down to answer it. People call us down and it's this Derek, and he goes, dude, we need you for dinner tonight. Well, this is where it got weird, because Sebe said, we can't make it. And Derek says, what are you talking about? And Sebi said, sorry, we can't make it. Anyway, the whole thing got bizarre, and Derek finally said, you have to make it. You have no idea what's going to happen at my house tonight, and you have to be here. I'm sending a car for you. And he did. So he sends his car, and he takes Sebi and I back to his house in Hampstead Heath, and we come in, and his girlfriend's cooking this huge dinner, and they got wine flowing, and they got pot, and everything's happening, and there are actual people there who are agents for people like EMI. Some great record labels were there that night.
You've got to be kidding me. You just walked into this because of an ad looking for another Brian Epstein? And it's incredible to hear this kind of a story. And what we're going to do is we're going to take a minute to pause here, and I'm going to turn up the music for a little bit and have people hanging on the edge of their seats. Thank you. you've got all this incredible stuff taking place. And for those who don't remember, during this time period is when the English bands were coming over here, and it was one of the incredible growth periods and a new type of music coming over. Everybody was waiting on the edge of their chair for, you know, who's going to be the next band coming over from England? And here you are dealing with the people who were actually sending the bands over here.
It's crazy. And you have to, again, you've got to go back and remember, tone deaf can't carry a beat. That's me. And Sebe, who's got this look, this Jesus Christ look, and he sings like almost like Leonard Cohen, but yet beautiful. And the songs were so simple. So we didn't really understand what was going on. And we get there that night, and Derek's talking to all these people, and they have the salad or something, and Derek would go, let me play you one of their songs. And that's how he did it. And so he would turn on one of these tracks that we did, and it would be utter silence during this 3-minute track. And when the track was over, everybody would go, oh my God, that was brilliant. And, you know, because Derek's an advertising guy, he starts handing out wine again. You know, round two of the food comes out and all this, blah, blah, blah. And then let's listen to another one. And then he would play the second one. And it was just like this crescendo. By the time we got to the fifth song, everybody was clamoring for our signature. Now remember, this was back when all of these guys were afraid that the next Beatles would come and go and they wouldn't sign them. So they're signing everybody, right? So they, but this is where it gets crazy, and you gotta understand. Sebe said to them that night, here's the deal. It's my thing. It's my music. It's my endeavor. And you work for me. And I'm not going to sign a contract that says you're going to give us £10,000 and record a song. Completely wrong. I get all of the proceeds from anything we ever sell, and I will give you what you deserve. And that is exactly how it's got to work. And there was complete and utter silence in the room, and Derek looked at Sebe like, are you freaking kidding me? So what happened was, we left that room that night, and that was the end of the dream.
You know, sometimes we are our own worst enemies, and you wonder what would have happened if maybe he'd gone to business school first and realized how the music business really works, and that you're not going to go anywhere.
No. You have to understand, the way the music industry worked then was people like Sebe. There were, I can't remember the names of them now, but there were a lot of one-hit wonders, and whose music played forever, and they never made a dime from it. So that's why the agents today have to get a license, because so many agents stole from so many artists that the politicians finally got involved and said, no, you can't just be an agent. You have to have credentials that say that you're an upstanding citizen, et cetera, et cetera. But it all came from the 60s and how many people got screwed. And Sebe said, being the smart man that he was, I will not be their puppet. They will be mine, because it's my music, and it's, we're going to be great, and I'm going to be the old man of pop, and you're going to be the fabulous idiot, and this is going to be the biggest thing that the music world has ever seen. And it wasn't about the music, it was about the show. And that's what they couldn't understand. So they bailed like rats from a sinking ship, and that was the end of that. So
that is absolutely the most incredible story I have heard in a long time. I mean, who knows what could have been from that, and to be sitting in a position to have all these people ready to sign you, and the deal breaker came out. How did you deal with it? How did you feel? And how did you get from there to where you are today?
Well, I don't know where exactly the chronology of all this gets a little lost, because it was 38 years ago or something like that. We were going to the moon when a lot of this was happening, 1969, I remember that. So what happened was, we were living in that place in East Putney. We all got arrested for pot. We didn't have any pot. We didn't have any money to buy any pot. But we got arrested for pot that they found in a fireplace with dogs, because they were looking for somebody else. And it's a long story. So I'm actually having to go to court with Sebe and with DeHilo and with the three or four other people that lived in that house in one room or another. And we had to stand in front of this judge and promise never to smoke pot again, which I refused to do. And the attorney said to me, fine, go to jail for 6 months. And I went, what? And he said, yeah, if you don't promise never to smoke pot again, the guy's going to put you in jail. So we all said, oh, yeah, we promise. And, you know, so in the meantime, I had to move back to my father's house because I was a ward of him in the country. I had a visa to live at his home, so they made me go back there. My dad was just crazy pissed. And he hired an attorney, and we beat this whole thing. And in the meantime, what the ramifications of that were was that if we got caught doing anything, littering, jaywalking, flipping a cop, whatever, the first thing in England that you do is serve the 6 months that they suspended our sentence. And then you go to court for what you did or didn't do. So it's not like America where you get an attorney and get to try. So I just finally told my dad, I think maybe it's time for me to go home. And he agreed. And on New Year's Eve day of 1969/70, I got on an airplane and I flew back to Los Angeles, California. And I've been back to England, but only 2 years ago, it was 40 years later. I never went back. I was supposed to go back. Seppi was all excited. We had this whole thing planned. But you know, something happened. I lost a jaw. I don't know. And I didn't go. And that was the last time I ever heard from him. He wrote a letter and said, what the hell were you thinking? He was at the airport waiting for me. But there had been some other nefarious situations happening between... anyway, I just stayed away. And I never saw the guy again. I never talked to the guy again. I had one picture of him, which I have lost. I haven't told this story to a whole lot of people. So wherever he went, he went. And what happened to me was I said, if I don't get a job and get serious, I'm going to end up living underneath a bridge. And my dad said, well, you're going to dig a ditch because you dropped out of college, you stupid fool. But dig the best ditch you know how to dig. And that was his only advice to me. And so I went to work for $2 an hour in a printing facility. And I finished a great 42-year career here a couple of years ago in printing. And during that period of time, I continued to play. I bought a Stratocaster. I bought a piano. I had a Hammond double keyboard M4, whatever it was, with a Wurlitzer speaker. I tried on several occasions to get people to play music with me, and I couldn't. But they couldn't learn how to. They had to play my stuff because I don't know how to play their stuff. I don't know how to play anything but what I did. So eventually, what I did was I bought this little cassette and I started double tracking. First, I'd put down a rhythm, then I'd put down a little lead, and it found out after playing the piano for a number of years that my lead fingers were better than they'd ever been. And then I took it to work one day, and this girl said, "Hey, if you have any words, I'll sing them for you because I want to sing." And I said, "Okay." So I went home and I wrote down all the words because each of my riffs had words. So I'd have to play 30 minutes and sing everything I knew about that went with that song, and then transcribe just the lines out of it that I wanted. So every song that I have created with words were created painstakingly one at a time. And in the end, I do have some of that with this woman singing, and we never did anything with it. And I kind of was like, after all these years, I spit out 50 some odd songs that I've been carrying with me all my life. And then I took the ones I liked the most, and what you're listening to in the background is just the musical compilations of whatever I could do and whatever you want to call it. And that's sort of how it is. I sit here today with no regrets. It was a really great experience. And I will end this by saying the night I left home, there was a huge decision I had to make in my life. I either had to go to France with the senior class on a ski trip for Christmas, or live in a lice-infested bedsetter with a couple of crazy people. And that's the one I chose. So all roads lead here. Thanks.
Well, if that doesn't deserve a book, I don't know what does. And I don't know if anybody's ever suggested to you that you might want to write your memoirs someday, because I'm sitting here fascinated and I can't wait to hear more. But that's it for the show today. Tom, I want to thank you for being here. You've left my head swimming with things that you just can't imagine, you know, being in that London during that time frame with the type of people you were hanging around with, and yet coming out of it the way you did, and then coming back and starting at the bottom in the printing industry where you worked and worked very well. And you, in spite of everything, you still have that musical connection. And we've been listening to it during the entire program, and it's been thoroughly enjoyable. I want to thank you for being here today, and for the rest of you, if you've got that music creativity and you think you're not a musician, think again.
Sebi said everyone's an artist, they just paint in different ways. Remember that.
And that's the way we'll end it today.